All right, welcome back. So tonight I'd like to explore, again, the addictive mind, but particularly the releasing of the addictive mind, the releasing of this addictive mind. And I think it's important to distinguish between the addictive process, so all the chemical, social, emotional aspects of addiction, with the addictive mind, which we'll focus on instead, which is the tendency towards suffering in a particular way, the relationship toward clinging, toward grasping, to contracting around a particular experience. So two weeks ago, and thank you, Steve, for taking last week's class, I had this working a definition of addiction. The addictive mind. And that's when our minds, the behavior starts to do us instead of us doing the behavior, that it starts to have a life of its own. We have this compulsion. It's really can be difficult to stop. You know, it can be show up in small ways, of course, very large and destructive ways. It also has a tie into a pleasure. There's some benefit that we receive, some sense of you know, feeling pleasure or maybe just relief of pain. And finally, my third aspect of definition was it has drawbacks. It causes suffering in some way, may or may not be obvious. So that was last week's talk in the way of exploring the addictive mind. And tonight I'd like to redefine this term, addictive mind, to really focus on this quality of clinging. Of clinging, the sense of a stickiness, of grasping. For those of you who walked through the last year's exploration of dependent origination, you recognize clinging as this important link in the whole chain. You know, right after feeling tone, we start to go to craving and then to clinging. It's this way we start to coalesce around this sense of self. And so in this way, the definition from last week really fits, that there's a way that the process starts to do us instead of us doing the process. It starts to really create this kind of locus of who we are. Simply beginning with wanting and not wanting. So you can start to see by holding addictive mind in this way, we can start to see the more subtle ways it shows up in our daily lives. Just the subtle way that when a thought arises, do we relate to it with one of non-clinging or of clinging? And is there a quality of compulsion, of being caught in, unable to release that? So let's explore it in this way, kind of more at the microscopic level. Now, exploring something on a very subtle level is actually very helpful because the subtleness has the same kernel, the same initial movement that creates these much bigger manifestations in our lives. When we're caught in the middle of a big manifestation, a big storm around something like the addictive mind, we're so almost too late because we're still so much in the midst of it. We're thinking more, having emotions, we're acting from that. It's generating all this internal storm, like a snowball running down the hill gets bigger and bigger. Now, if we can learn to train ourselves to pay attention to those subtle qualities, it actually gives us enough space to start to really unpack it, to start to see the nature of it, and to start to become free of it. So noticing those subtle aspects, sometimes it's easy just to gloss over those because we do have to really bring our attention, bring our intentionality to really notice those qualities. But these are some of the deepest learnings if you're open to that. Just seeing something like a bird song and, oh, I wonder what bird that is. And how suddenly we're relating to it from a different place versus just hearing the sound and having this deep immediacy of experience, this deep intimacy with what's being heard. So with this addictive mind, it has these three aspects, again, of it starts to do us, it starts to create this sense of me around it. It has this payoff, this benefit, you know, seen or unseen. And then also has suffering, you know, maybe a more or less obvious connection to our suffering, to our distress, to our dis-ease. Now, we are suffering, but we may not connect the dots. We may not realize, oh, I'm suffering because of this addictive mind in this case. I mean, there's many different ways we could plug into this whole exploration. And it can be hard to see that because this is often the very underlying unexamined assumption of what we base our lives on, based our thoughts, our experiences, how we act in the world, how we show up in the world. And until we see through that, until we see the kind of the absence of that sense of self, it's just this background assumption that really drives everything. That being said, if we train ourselves to start to notice that sense of self falls away all the time, and during the day we kind of forget ourselves. We kind of gloss over that because that's not really engaging us. It's not keeping us caught. You know, the addictive mind isn't activated in that moment. But if we start to see the simplicity of it, the ordinariness of it, it can really be, you start to see how much it's really there. So tonight, again, I want to talk about this releasing the addictive mind. Now, what is the opposite of addiction? The addictive mind in this case. This is the non-clinging mind, the mind that is not based in clinging. So again, there's a very technical definition we can look at from dependent origination, a mind that doesn't kind of load us into the sense of self, doesn't kind of form us like clay into a sense of me. It also has a non-sticky quality, like the meditation we did, that sense of letting go. This arises, it's met, and it's released. It's released as soon as it's experienced. And if you're able to practice with that, with the sensations, with sound, with thoughts, even with that sense of you as the meditator, as it comes into your perspective, you start to release it. You start to see that life's relationship and you and that relationship starts to transform, starts to change into one that's open, that's receptive. You start to see with a freshness and with an immediacy. So this is the releasing of the addictive mind. Another way to say this is one of my favorite teaching poems these days. And I don't know how you feel about poems that, you know, get read over and over again. But I remember in the early days, Rodney would often read poems, you know, many times. On retreats in particular. And I started to really appreciate those familiar poems because they became this kind of gateway into this. They became really a teaching in themselves. I find particular phrases holding in my mind as I went through life. Started to really seep in and transform. This is a short one, untitled, by Samuel Green. That everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. Everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. Walking the yard with coffee cooling in my hand, I stop at a single seed of hawksbeard balanced on a blade of grass. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? Everything we see carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. This is saying the same thing about the non-clinging mind, the non-addictive mind. How we place this burden on everything that we see. I like that, you know, I label it, I know what it is, and then I like it. I want more of it. I want less of it. But that's something that we've projected onto life, onto this moment. And so learning to release that burdening, that unburdening, being unburdened, releasing, so it can be itself again. This is the non-addictive mind. This is the non-clinging mind. So how do we release this addictive mind? Because, you know, we know how gripping it can be. even, whether it's gripping of a substance, a chemical substance addiction, or just the normal day addictive qualities that come up in our minds. How do we release that? And when we approach something from this perspective, okay, this causes suffering, this causes distress. How can I release this? How can I open my heart, release it so my heart opens? It's very important to bring along wise action. Okay, so wise action is a part of the Eightfold Path, which is a part of the Four Noble Truths. So by bringing this forth, we're aligning ourselves with wise view, with wise intention, which simply said is understanding the cause of suffering and the release of that suffering. A little more subtle way of experiencing that is understanding the arising of self and the release of that self. So wise effort, wise action has this as a basis. And in particular, wise action has four parts. And just to touch upon those, it's releasing the unwholesome which has arisen. So the addictive mind arises, and how is that released? Then how do we help that not arise in the first place? And then noticing the mind of non-clinging when that arises, how to allow that to arise, and once it's arisen, how to maintain it, how to allow it to sustain. So the addictive mind could be a very fruitful place to apply wise action, wise effort. And tonight I'd like to offer three practices, three ways of working with this addictive mind, and this the releasing of it, the cooling of the addictive mind. And hopefully this will be a helpful, one of these at least will be helpful for your own practice. And each of these can support wise action. They release the addictive mind, helping the addictive mind not to arise in the first place, helping the non-clinging mind to arise, and helping that non-clinging mind to sustain itself. So keep that in mind as we explore that, these three practices. So imagine the addictive mind is arising. Maybe it's arising in some way right now as we speak. It doesn't matter what it's toward, a substance, toward food, toward a person, an experience, an activity, a role, a thought. So as it arises and our mind goes into that clinging, that contraction, then it's very helpful just to be wise action to bear on this. The first method or first technique or practice is to see the dukkha, to see the dukkha in this experience. This is the first noble truth. This is the start of the Buddha's path. Because if we don't see the suffering in this activity, why would we go further? Why would we examine it? Like, well, there's no problem. So let me just see where that suffering is. And sometimes it's a little obscured, particularly around addictive processes or addictive mind. It gets quite obscured. Now, it's helpful to pause, to bring that sense of pause, of kind of in the midst of when the addictive mind starts to become activated, either or in the first impulse of when you first notice it, that subtle quality, to pause, to start to allow us to see through the perceived benefit to the suffering underneath it, and over the suffering that arises after that experience or that activity. So this is about seeing it very, very clearly, seeing it to the depth, like almost you feel it in your bones. So not like an intellectual sense of, oh yeah, that's not a good thing to do. It's makes me unhappy. But to really register that in a very deep, almost cellular way. Not conceptually, but in the bones. This helps us to start to release the addictive mind when we connect that, connect the suffering with that action. That releasing of addictive mind, that's the wise action, that first part. That connecting the dukkha with the behavior. It's like we went out and picked up a stone by the fireplace or the fire campfire, and it was so hot that it burned our hands. We would learn from that, and we wouldn't pick it up again. But if we were maybe overly optimistic or delusional, we'd say, well, maybe this next stone isn't so hot. I'm going to test it out. I think we've all done that. We've burned ourselves, but we keep seeing, okay, maybe I won't burn myself this time. Maybe it won't be so bad. But if we fully see it, we fully take it in, we don't pick up that stone again. Yeah. And so that's what this first stage is learning, is to really see that dukkha, to really connect with it. So it's unequivocal. Okay, I clearly see it. I clearly know it. So to do this, I like to use the body as a teacher, because the body has its own wisdom that sometimes we can talk ourselves out of, we can ignore it. But if we learn to really use the sensations of our body as a reference point, just as we practice feeling the breath, feeling the subtle sensations in the body, we can start to notice when the body reacts, especially when it's different than what our mind or our words are saying. So helpful to see that difference, that dissonance. So I might be doing some activity and see that addictive mind starting to arise, to be seen. Okay? As soon as I notice that activation of that clinging, if I can pause in some way, suspend my actions. This is important, because otherwise the actions kind of cover up what we're trying to see. It's like there's this pressure that's building up, and by acting on it, we kind of are engaging in it, and we're also becoming lost in it. If we're able to pause for a moment, so it could just be a few moments, could be a few minutes, you start to feel that pause. You feel the impulse to move without actually moving, the impulse to think more about this, the impulse to speak about it, to write an email. But by pausing, the impulse almost becomes highlighted. If I act on the impulse, then I don't get to see this deeper energy that's underneath them. And then the thing just keeps expressing itself. It goes back into the unconscious. So with that pausing of the action, then I start to tune into my body to see what is present. What is the wisdom of the body showing in this moment? And feeling the tightness, the constriction. And for me, often when I practice in this way, there's the addictive process, the invitation to do that. I'm pausing. I can feel the sense of urgency, almost like the whole body needs to do something in order to, have some sense of fulfillment. There's a sense of unrest, of agitation, a sense of unpleasantness. It's inherently unpleasant to not have followed through on that addictive quality. And so, usually the solution is just to follow through on it. So you relieve that. But then we're just back into that whole cycle. So pausing, feeling what the body has to teach. Another way is to really hear and be open, or even more, invite feedback from your friends, your loved ones, your family about the impact of your addictive behavior, the compulsive behavior. Tell me how it's like when I'm acting that way. And they probably, if they are connected to you, if they're close to you, they will know what you're talking about. They'll say, oh yeah, you go into that mode. And then you do this, and this is how it feels. And I found, again, as I spoke about in response to a question a couple weeks ago, that this is very helpful, because it starts to cut through a lot of the delusion. Because if we just do this internally with our own internal dialogue, we can kind of tell our own stories the way we want to tell it. But we hear someone else's feedback, hopefully in a loving, kind way, we're able to look more closely. This starts to, again, this is all about releasing the addictive mind. It's trying to cool the fire of it. And then finally, with this particular one, this noticing the dukkha, noticing the suffering. Stepping back and, just as we do with the body, looking at how the mind is, kind of the shape of the mind. What does that feel like? There's a contraction of the mind. There's a narrowing of the mind. There's a sense of almost being isolated from the rest of life, except for that one object that your addictive mind has set upon, has become obsessed around. And is that pleasurable? Is that peaceful? Or is that dukkha, is that suffering. So this first one is really about learning to connect with the suffering underneath, to see that, to feel that, to start to almost sober us up about how we create distress in this addictive mind. Now, it can often be hard to see this suffering. You know, it could be that sometimes the pleasure of it kind of outweighs the pain of it. It's like, well, I know this isn't so good for me, but it tastes so good to do this, or it's so, I enjoy this, I get this kind of pleasure. And we kind of weigh those two, and often the pleasure overcomes the awareness or connection with the suffering. So this is where the next practice comes in. And this is one I've spoken about a number of times, but I think it's always a good reminder. And this is using death as an advisor. Using death as an advisor. And this is one of the five reflections that the Buddha recommended people do on a daily basis, you know, both for them, whether they're monks or nuns, lay people, it doesn't matter. It's very helpful to do these reflections. And one of the most poignant is to realize that I too am subject to death. I've not gone beyond death. Now, when you hold that up in the midst of an addictive mind storm, what happens? It's like there's this almost like throwing cold water on your face. You kind of come out of the trance that the addictive mind has induced upon you. And how does it start to change your relationship to that addictive mind? Does it change the power of the addictive mind? It brings this perspective that what is really, truly important. When I talk about this death as an advisor, you know, this is something that Carlos Castaneda spoke about in one of his books. And here's a quote from that book. You have to be aware of the uselessness of your self-importance and of your personal history. Your death can give you a little warning. It always comes as a chill. Death is our eternal companion. It is always to our left at an arm's length. How can anyone feel so important when they know that death is stalking us? The thing to do when you're impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just have the feeling that your companion is there watching you. The issue of our death is never pressed far enough. Death is the only wise advisor that we have. So next time that addictive mind arises, imagine that death is hanging out over your left shoulder, just about arm's length away. You're at some point going to tap you on your shoulder. And you get to explore what that is like. But until that tap, it gives you this perspective of like, okay, how does this addictive process, the pleasure that I get from it, amount to the fact that I'm mortal, that my life is finite? If this is the last week of my life, would I choose to engage in this addictive mind? And, you know, play with the time frames. You know, we can make this a kind of an expiration. Like if you had 10 years to live, how would that affect the process? 5 years, 1 year, 6 months, 1 month, 1 week, 1 day. And for me, as I did this, you know, I was thinking, well, 10 years, I can still kind of play with this addictive process for a while. I got, you know, 2 more years I'll do it, then I'll get serious. You know, it's kind of, there's that, you have to find, where does it kind of kick in? If I go to like 1 day, maybe the fear or the panic would kind of overwhelm it and I kind of lose the aliveness of it. So you can experiment. Where is that duration? How much life do you have left? If you had a week, a month, a year, what would bring that aliveness, that perspective that when the addictive mind arises, that wise action just is right there with it and says, okay, this clearly leads to suffering, and just falls away. what perspective on your own mortality arises. You know, what duration, how much more would really make you wake up and naturally fall in to non-clinging, fall into the immediacy of life, to walk out into nature and seeing the beauty of nature and letting it fully impact you, fully come in. Meeting a loved one, a perfect stranger, and having no sense of time, no sense of impatience, just connection. Even your own breath, even a cessation or a sound, holding each one as a precious gift that you know is finite. So using death as an advisor to help us wake up to release this addictive process, this addictive mind, I should say. So then the final one. So we've talked about this, seeing the suffering, seeing the dukkha very clearly, seeing it as a felt sense in our bones. If that doesn't work, if we're kind of still like, I like the pleasure of it, asking death to advise you. And then the final one I want to share. This is the disillusionment with the sense of self. The disillusionment with the sense of self. And this is ultimately what transforms us, transforms the addictive mind or any kind of mind we might have, is starting to become disillusioned with that sense of self in general and in specifically. Because the addictive mind is charged, is a charged movement toward that process of clinging to selfing. It's how the sense of self kind of arranges itself around this addictive mind, seeking pleasure, avoiding pain. And that also this quality of choosing not to see the limitations. And so the whole kind of constellation, the whole system is really oriented around this sense of self. Okay, so the sense of self, there's kind of a baseline perspective and delusion. There's also kind of the relative senses of self, which are constantly arising each day, each moment, and throughout our lifetime. I mean, looking at the Sangha today, and I see people in different stages in their life, those with young children, those who are single, those with maybe children have grown up, different places in your work, different places in your health, different places, different expressions of gender, of race. Each of these are aspects of self. You know, there's ways that we hold, this is who I am. This is how I identify with who I am. I am a heterosexual white male. You know, so that's kind of identity. I am a father. I am a husband. Those are all senses of me that arises in that moment, right? And they have their utility, right? But they also are all finite. If I'm going and doing something completely different, I may not keep holding that one sense of self. My daughter's not in the room. I'm not talking with her or about her. Then that fades into the background. A different sense of me arises. So if you start to look, it's kind of constantly arising. I'm passing away. And you know, I think all of us, if we reflect, know the times when that sense of self that we perhaps appreciated and liked got stripped away from us. And we lost our job. We lost our health. We lost our loved one. We were tired. Our children moved away. Our children passed away. All these processes, like life has this way of showing us constantly this lesson that the sense of self is arising and it's constantly fading. And so the addictive mind has this own kind of quality of forming around. Think of it like a solar system, that you have a sun in the middle with all these planets orbiting around its gravity field. Okay, that sense of self is that sun with its deep gravity and the way it organizes the way those planets move. And those planets are behaviors, they're actions, they're ways of being in the world. There's ways of kind of showing up thought processes. There's so many different ways, so many different planets that are rising around. You know, the very way we perceive the world is one of those planets. You know, we don't see that sun, that which is revolving around. You know, there's Venus, there's Mars, there's Jupiter. And it profoundly affects how we speak, how we act, how we think, how we are in the world. And then you start to work with it, start to become curious about that sun. You know, is that really as solid as I thought it was? And this is where this disillusionment starts to come in, either through, it's not really often a particular choice. It starts to release from us. We start to see more and more clearly, like the first practice, feeling that dukkha, feeling the burn on our hands. We do that enough times, we don't want to pick up that rock. That starts to loosen that aspect, that one sun, it starts to fall away. Gaining perspective from death as an advisor. Also, the sense of that sun starts to fade away. And so those planets start to float around without that coordinating and, the gravity field is gone. And you may have noticed and reflect on this in your life that there's things that I used to find so passionate in my life that I was so engaged in. And now they don't have that same draw. And a lot of it is that sense of self that was organized around that all those activities and beliefs circled around, that's faded to some degree or quite a degree, depending on which area I'm talking about. And then those activities, they kind of float, but they don't have that same orienting quality. They don't still all reference back that sense of self, that sense of me. Right? So it's a little, in some ways, it is a disillusionment, because there's this enchantment that we have with self. This is kind of perhaps the deepest addiction that we have. Addiction to the sense of me, the sense of self. When those planets start to go adrift, there's this transition period when we start to relax into something holding them other than that planetary field of gravity or that solar field of gravity, but actually space itself, the sense of stillness. To push that metaphor to breaking, but it just, there's a particular shift of perspective. So this disillusionment, you know, so you start to see through, okay, I'm not going to be fooled by this anymore. I was watching a movie with my family, and one character just said that he was starting to engage in an old behavior, and then at one point he stopped and said, I am just not that person anymore. And I think, you know, as I talked about 2 weeks ago, those who have really worked their recovery, you know, they've really been facing their addiction and gone through a deep process of recovery and a sense of really integrating around that. There's a sense of self that's transformed. There's something that's fallen away. You know, that consolation, that sense of me has shifted to a different location. So these three aspects of working with, of releasing the addictive mind, seeing the dukkha so clearly, so directly, that takes time because we're trained to look away, to not see, having that patience to sustain our gaze, keeping the spaciousness so we don't become tense and overtaught. Asking death advice, our own death, in that perspective, in that reality, that I won't live forever. Where does this addictive process fit in? Is this how I want to spend my time? Is this how I want to spend my limited time? And then finally, the disillusionment with that sense of self that the addictive mind revolves around. Start to be curious of that. And this again starts to let go of us. All right, I think that's enough words for tonight. Let's just sit quietly for a few moments, and then I'll talk about the practice and reflection. And as we sit, feel the immediacy of the letting go, All we have to do is not to hold on, not to cling. And whatever fears or unease may come from not holding, if you trust it, you're rewarded by something else rising in. Life comes to embrace you. The letting go and the embrace of life. All right, thank you for your attention, engagement. So let's talk a little bit about the practice of reflection, the homework for this week. Copy. I'll put that in the chat for your benefit. Okay, there it is. So this week, start to notice the subtle aspects, the subtle expressions of the addictive mind. So this is, you know, starting to pay attention to just when there's a little bit of like charge around this moment's experience. This is, if you hold it in this way, it's going to be probably most moments are going to have some charge, some sense of just when you're not allowing life to be just how it is, there's usually some quality of clinging going on. Okay, just how much you engage in, how much you jump into that. And you can start to notice in the very subtle ways, and this is a nice way to work with it because it's easier, it's less, takes less effort. And the clarity can be much clearer because you're not so confused. So how does it show up in ordinary moments? So this is like daily life stuff, Dharma and daily life. How does it show up when you, first thing you wake up in the morning, the first, you know, text or email, social media that you receive, you know, the first site that you see, the first person you talk to, you know, see, notice there in those little moments, you know, around mealtimes, around entertainment, these are all great ways to just notice, just pause for a few moments and notice if there's that clinging quality. And then from there, play with these three practices. You know, first, it's trying to clearly see, is there suffering here? Is there some level of insufficiency, of dis-ease? It may be buried. It may be hard to see. It may be easy to overlook. But starting to highlight that, to really connect with that. If you find one that kind of resonates, you say, oh, wow, I didn't realize that this activity had that kernel of suffering. When you're surprised, that's a really great place to really double down and investigate more. Because that surprise is showing you, you're seeing life in a different way. You're starting to see the practice unfold in front of you in a different way. So if you feel that, just start to really, okay, can I feel that subtleness? Can I really see the deepness of that suffering? And sometimes it gets to the point where you just feel it's almost an existential dukkha level of suffering. Practice using death as an advisor. You know, not to get caught up and heavy with this, but just to bring, again, play with that time frame. Like, okay, if I had a month to live, would I still relate to this addictive mind in the same way? Find that sweet spot that allows you to find both the immediacy without very much fear and terror. And finally, the disillusionment with a sense of self, the addictive mind revolves around. Start to get a sense how the sense of you is kind of, there's this core of it that all the addictive processes in mind and thoughts revolve around. As you start to notice with the first two, you may start to see that core starts to become, you start to see through it. That's really it. You just see through it. And then it becomes, doesn't hold the same power over you. So let's practice with that. And then next week, I'm actually going to do a climate crisis talk for the Honoring Earth Day. And then, so we might do this homework in 2 weeks, or I might do something about climate change for this discussion on the last Monday of this month. Haven't decided yet. All right, so now we have a chance to hear from you, to see how practice is going, how this talk may have landed in the areas of curiosity, of interest, of sharing. And also, if you want to talk about your practice and engagement in daily life in general, that's also welcome. So you can either unmute yourself and just start speaking, or you could raise your virtual hand, or you could even put a chat there. Right, complete clarity. Everyone's fully enlightened. That's wonderful. I know sometimes it's hard to find that. You know, what is there to talk about, or what to ask? And you know, you don't have to be perfect in it. You know, the questions I really appreciate, because it's a chance to really to engage, you know, with where the topic is with you.
Tim, hi, it's Susan.
Hey, Susan.
I can't use my video because of a bad connection.
Yes.
Go ahead and tell me. You framed the three aspects of this clinging mind and two things came to me. One was I heard you use wise action as kind of a wise effort as an entry point. And in reflecting on my own experience, it's interesting because I had to see the truth in someone else. So in a way, it was Sangha or community, external, clear seeing. I've had to hear the truth from someone else reflected back to me. And then my heart, deeper suffering. And I know we enter these paths at different locations. And faith, and what a leap that we take from dependent co-arising. Really, that's kind of what I'm suffering, the clinging, the addictive mind, sense of self, the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, you know, all the bells and whistles being pulled. We see that now. It's clearly seen. And it's just like we are no longer want to be fooled by that. So thank you. Thank you for tonight.
You're welcome, Susan. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's, yeah, that sense of seeing it in someone else and, you know, seeing the truth reflected back to you. That's also a very profound way. I think that is the power of Sangha. You know, that's the way that the practice gets amplified when we, you know, Sangha isn't just the Buddhist Sangha. It could be the recovery Sangha. It could be whatever like-minded people are really trying to see things clearly. And that's a very well said. So thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else like to share or ask anything? Lauren, I see you are unmuted.
Yes. Can you see my, do I have a hand up? I thought I put
I do now, yes.
Okay, good, good. I'm just learning how to use that. So I was thinking when you were talking about the things to do, that the first one about the dukkha and pausing and let the body sensations, I wrote it down, you know, learn from your body sensations. And then I was imagining noticing the impulse to act, you know, on that compulsion to satisfy this craving, and but to pause even then. And you said, see the deeper energy that's underneath that. And I thought, yeah, that's a place I could really learn from. And sometimes it's really hard to pause there. But I just was kind of imagining me doing that. And I thought that that would be something that, you know, because you want to follow through to get to the pleasure, but you don't. And then you see what, you know, you kind of try to uncover what's really going on underneath that drive for that pleasure. So anyway, I thought that was really, would be powerful, and I appreciate you talking about that.
Yeah, way to make that. You know, sometimes it is hard because it's almost unconscious that we're reaching for that extra cookie before we even realize that we're in that addictive mind, kind of co-opt our whole mind and our body, and we're just acting from it. So if you have something that, like, let's say it is a cookie, you know, and you just put that cookie, you just set a little structure, set a timer for, let's say, 5 minutes, put the cookie right in front of you, and just sit there and watch the cookie, reflect on the cookie, and watch what comes up. It's like, you know, I mean, sometimes you can just feel like, you know, the arm is like wanting to move, like,
right,
you know, in Dr. Strangelove when he was like choking himself. It's like, it wants to move by itself. And so you pause and you feel that. And it has a finite time. So you can kind of, okay, I can do this for 5 minutes. And at the end, you know, give yourself the cookie, you know, if you still want it. But just be really curious. So again, there's the impulse to feel the movement. That's the first layer. And then if you pause with that, you say, okay, what happens if I don't move? This is really interesting. If I don't follow that impulse, it gets a little more intense. And then I can, if I'm able to be still with that, I can see deeper underneath that. Oh, there's that sense of lack, that sense of insufficiency. You know, Jeanine Roth, one of her books, Feeding the Hungry Heart, you know, you can sometimes feel, oh, this cookie is trying to feed this hungry part. You know, not saying that's anyone else's experience, but just become curious to see what's really there.
Yeah.
And then once you touch into that, bring compassion to it. Mm-hmm. Bring that sense of, you know, almost really it's a deep unconditional love for that part. And then you ask, okay, what would be truly helpful? What would be truly supportive? And sometimes it might be something very different. And sometimes you might realize this deep hunger, this deep insufficiency is actually inherent in everything. There's like nothing is going to fill that because it's based in a fundamental delusion of self and other, of separation. So you always, again, I'm kind of going deep there, but, you know, if you can, sometimes you can notice this, that deep down, there's this fundamental sense of lack that you try to fill in all these different ways, but it's really based on the essential delusion of separation. And only releasing that is when that falls away.
Releasing the separation, sense of me, you, I, other, that kind of thing.
So. Yeah, letting life embrace you without any sense of having to, you know, that sense of of separation. And I'm not talking about, you know, appropriate boundaries. That's another important right. skill that we actually will talk about later this year, boundaries in daily life. But this is just this moment by moment, fully releasing any sense of separation. Okay. And that's just something that, you know, I discovered around, you know, going the same process. You may have a different discovery. And so the important thing is to really do the work yourself, yeah. to do the investigation yourself, and, you know, holding the pause, taking that, you know, getting the time frame. And it's nice to notice it in times when you really don't have a choice to act. You can't really act because it's not socially appropriate, but you still feel that urge to come up. Okay, let me feel the urge. Let me not shame myself or judge myself, but really feel it, experience it, and then just see what is there. You know, and it starts to reveal itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome, Lauren. All right, so it looks like Kristen, I see your hands next. Go ahead.
Ron was before me.
Ron was for, okay, so let's go with Ron then first, and we'll come back to you. Okay, Ron, go ahead. Okay, Ron, you're still muted, sorry. I might have unmuted you when you were unmuting yourself, and I canceled you out. Okay, you're unmuted.
So go ahead. I've been, you know, paying a lot of attention to addictive behavior lately. And it's, you know, I know that for myself, I tend to really cling to something. And if I like it, then I tend to go for it. Even, and it's like the two little things, I can't remember their names, that sit on the shoulders. Odipa or whatever, you know, I
yes.
don't win, you know, I go ahead and give in to the craving. And then because I know that it will abate within a week or two. And so I was thinking about how to deal with that a little bit, the pausing and, you know, and then I, you know, I'm also going through some other things, but like you said, you know, when you've got about 10 years left, you go, oh, well, why not indulge myself? I might not be here tomorrow. So I've been having that little side argument and so I thought about that when you were talking to Lauren, and I thought, well, you said going deeper, and I took it in a different way, and maybe there's something deeper going on. I know that there is, and I'm just not addressing it or something, but I'm doing most of the things you said, but I'm not really applying them conscientiously. So I don't know if there's a way to move into that or how to look into to what's going on that's more, a little deeper than just that surface thing of craving and addiction.
Well, a good question that comes up is that, why do that? Why go into seeing what's deeper?
Well, I just think there might be something. As I listened to you talking, I thought, well, there is something else that's going on deeper, because I have, you know, I have been becoming more aware of my mortality since I'm closer. Hmm. And so it's easier for me to kind of use that as a crutch or an excuse, you know, oh, I'll go ahead and have that extra little piece of ice cream or whatever it happens to be. I just feel I need to deal with that part. You know, I don't know exactly how to get to that second issue.
So there's kind of mortality is like, well, it's all going to end, so why not just go out with a bang kind of a thing?
Yeah, I've got, you know, 15 years tops, you know, so so it's pretty easy to indulge myself thinking, well, what if it isn't 15 years, you know? I mean, I'm not really afraid of death, so I just can go out fat or skinny, you know?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's different ways of that, of approaching that. And that's a personal choice. I guess what I would say, Ron, is like the territory of seeing, there has to be some reason to look, want to look. And often it has to do with, you know, just the pain becomes, it's just, you don't want to do that anymore. You know, and so there's that pleasure pain ratio. And sometimes the pleasure outweighs the pain. It's like, well, you know, I can deal with that little bit of pain. And so it's like trying to see, you know, where is that, that motivation? It's like the, you know, like the 12th step, the hitting bottom is like, it's just, okay, this is just not going to work anymore. I mean, there's this point, and it can be, you know, horrendous stuff more and more and more. And finally something shifts, something connects that. So there's that piece. So that kind of has to come internally, you know, it has to have that own reason to look. But let's make it a little bit more accessible for, you know, where I sense you're coming from. And just pick one of the things that you find that addiction comes around, something that's, you know, pretty easy and not so charged. And just make it a little bit of a short-term project, maybe for a month or a few weeks. And give yourself a little structure around it. So let's say it's something like, you know, having ice cream or something like that. Something that, you know, you enjoy. But you also feel that kind of compulsion around it. So it's important to approach it with the idea that, okay, I'm not going to try to change this or fix it or stop it. I just want to understand it. I want to see what's there. Okay, so by doing that, you say, okay, I'm going to get my bowl of ice cream and put it in front of me. I'm going to set a timer, like I talked about with Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of going right into the ice cream, you're just going to give yourself 5 minutes of just contemplating what it feels like to think about eating ice cream. Okay, so there's the anticipation, there's the, you know, lack of satiation because you're not having the ice cream right away. Maybe there's the thoughts of it melting, whatever it might be. And just start to just notice what comes up. All right? Without any agenda, without trying to get rid of this, doing this in order to get rid of, but just to know, just to understand. And particularly notice if there's any aspects that, oh, just, you know, just feels really unpleasant not to have the ice cream right in my mouth right when I want it. Okay, so one solution is just to have the ice cream whenever you want it. So there's no gap between wanting and the fulfillment of that want. But, you know, we know that there's lots of things in our life that we can want and never have. It's to say, okay, what's it like to want something that I'm not having? Start to tune into where that's felt as a body experience. What's the kind of the shape of the whole mental mechanism, you know, the whole thought process? Does that start to change around that experience? You know, just, you know, don't, you know, do that, you know, a few times a week and just kind of become curious about it. Maybe jolt down a few notes about it to bring some clarity to it. And then enjoy that metaphorical bowl of ice cream or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think I'm getting that part. And also just hearing you talk about this makes me feel like it's not the ice cream, the addiction thing itself. That's a symptomatic of something else that's going on. So I think I just need to stop the inertia and start activity, step off the side of the cliff, so to speak, and get moving.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That stepping off the cliff, that if there's that sense of having to step off a cliff, that's probably worthwhile doing.
Yeah, it takes a few minutes before you feel out, maybe you can fly, you know?
Yes.
So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Okay, Kirsten. From California, live from California.
California, Davis. Anyway, you know, one of the things that I struggle with is definitely, one of the things that helps me deal with, especially issues that I can't control, that I have absolute zero control about, that's what raises my anxiety more than anything. You could give me a million deadlines. That doesn't really stress me out. That, you know, that's fine. But when there's issues with a family or a friend or things I can't control, I tend to feel like I have a bouncing basketball in me. And so those are the times I struggle in my meditation, not because I don't want to sit down, but that I physically feel like my body is jumping. Yeah. And so, you know, clearly having a regular practice kind of helps kind of create a baseline for me, which I know is really helpful. So I'm there. But then I also struggle with like physically over moving. And so then I'll tend to create injuries. And I've done this multiple times throughout my life with different sports, different activities to get that to basically exhaust myself. Mm. I'm not relaxing myself. I'm exhausting myself physically. Yeah. But it's really, it's a struggle. So I've started using, especially in this past year, with the pandemic and my husband's job, it's been a very stressful year and things I can't control. So I started walking again and started walking way too much. So I started using my watch so that I can kind of measure so I don't go over a certain amount of exercise.
Yeah.
But do you have a suggestion? Because, I mean, I do a lot of counting, especially backwards counting in my meditation. Yeah. But it's not my mind that's going crazy. I don't mean that in a negative way, I'm sorry. But it's my physical body. The sensations in my body are, like, overpowering.
Yeah, so there's a really strong quality of restlessness. Yeah. You know, and worry, you know, that basic hindrance. And that sense of, if you look at the kind of the addictive mind, it's like exercising, the way you're describing, it's a way of escaping that pain. You know, it's going into that the sense of exhaustion to overcome that distress. So, and that basic sense of out-of-controlness, you know, when we can't control something, when it's so, you know, beyond, you know, our capacity, just because we don't, it's too big of a thing, or it's just other people's or choices. So a couple things that come to mind. So you said you're using a lot of counting. So counting is a concentration focus, you know, like, okay, you know, you really give your mind something to focus on, helps to collect, helps to calm the system. So you could do the same thing like with noting and, you know, you're saying breathing in, breathing out, or just simply focusing on sensations. So that's one strategy. That strategy, though, doesn't allow us to learn in the same way. If we're able to just go more into an insight or Vipassana practice and just allowing the very thing that we're struggling with to be seen. Okay, so when we start to allow it to be seen and fully experienced, then, you know, then we can start to learn from it. Of course, the trick is that with what you're describing, as you start to open to it, it becomes overwhelming, right? It becomes too much, like, oh, this is just, like you said, the bouncing basketball inside you is like going all over the place. And so this is what I would suggest that you practice with, is taking almost like a, well, part of it is reflecting on the fact that you don't have control, and trying to find a sense of almost like that becomes a mantra. Okay, you know, letting go, like we've worked on tonight. Practice letting go in small ways, and start to notice in small ways how you don't have. There's just an illusion of control. You can, you know, you're a very highly capable person, so you can apply effort to get the illusion of control happening. But just notice that, what's the next thought that's going to come to your mind? The next sound that you're going to hear? The next sensation that you're going to feel? That's also outside of your control. And so you start to develop this relationship to things arising outside of your control, that at some point it actually turns on its head, that instead of being something that's distressing, it actually becomes a place of wonder. It's a sense of aliveness, like, wow, I don't have control of this arising of this moment. And it's amazing. It's wonderful to just simply observe that. And so I'm suggesting you do this in ways which aren't charged. They don't have a lot of personal meaning, like what's happening with your children or with your husband or with work, because the personal meaning gets so hooked up right now. So you start to learn that in kind of easy ways. And, you know, once you kind of do your noting practice or your counting practice, have a period in your practice that you're just letting experience show what it's showing. You know, there's the bouncing ball. Okay, let's just sit with the bouncing ball going around. Try to make that not the size of your room, but size of a basketball court. So that ball has lots of space to move all over the place. You know, Suzuki Roshi, I think, had this beautiful quote, a description of if you had a wild horse and you put it in a small stall, it would buck and kick and cause lots of damage to itself and their surroundings. But that same wild horse out on the meadow, you know, buck around for a while, but eventually just naturally quiet down. So how do you create that sense of internal space, that internal spaciousness? All right, so there's a lot of things there to play with. So yeah, keep dialoguing around that. That's really a helpful thing to explore. Not only, I'm sure many people can relate to that experience. So thank you, Kirsten. All right, we have time for one more.
Tim, thank you so much for your talk. It was very, very, it was very helpful. And I found myself thinking at one point you talked about that once we find our non-clinging mind, that we want to kind of hold on to it and stabilize it. And that immediately got me wondering, well, wouldn't that cause one to cling to non-clinging? And is that something that's worth worrying about, I guess, or do you have any insights on that problem?
Yes, yeah, it's a good point to talk about. And I was talking in the reference to the four wise efforts or wise actions, and you know, there's releasing what's unwholesome, you know, helping what's unwholesome not to arise, then helping what's wholesome to arise. You know, one could say the non-clinging mind, and then helping that sustain itself. But you're absolutely right. We can get caught in wanting to keep that sustained and becomes a sense of clinging. I mean, basically, we're wired to cling. And so we can take something that's, you know, a non-clinging state when there's just this immediacy of the moment and we want to get back to it. You know, I was sitting at a particular time, a particular place. I'm going to duplicate that. You know, I'm going to make sure everything's just, you know, and we can chase, like we're chasing our own tail, trying to find that. And so that's one of the deeper levels of wise effort, is to learning how to have effortless effort. And so that sustaining of that non-clinging, it is a very slippery slope because it's so easy to apply our normal strategy. So, you know, I remember seeing this when I first really started to see this, is that I realized any kind of movement, any sense of wanting, of trying to do something with my practice. So this is like in the context of a retreat, that moved away from that. And so, you know, words like surrender make more and more sense. That as I do it right now, it's almost a sense of almost holding my breath, because like even breathing too hard will kind of disrupt it. And you just, it's like you're sitting in the woods, like this, maybe you've sat in the woods quietly and suddenly a deer walks in and you realize, oh, if I look at it, it's going to run away. But if I'm able to just calm myself, it stays as long as it stays. So it's one of those real interesting points in practice, is how do we allow that to sustain itself? And really, we have to get out of our own way. And we will get in our way a lot before we realize how to not get in our way. Does that help?
Yes. Yes, I think so. And I love the deer metaphor. That's very, very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your question. And thank you all for your questions and engagement. You know, it really helps us to explore the topic in a very immediate, personal way. And you know, different aspects of my teaching comes out in response to your questions. And the Buddha often, I mean, he didn't like do talks like this. He would just respond to people's questions. And I wish I could just do talks that way. Just have to come up with something, but this is the way we do it. So as we, so again, next week we'll have the climate crisis talk. And then the week after that, we'll have some type of discussion group. So I'll do a recap of one of these talks and a chance for us to engage in it. I want to also just point share that I'm talking to Carrie Peterson, who's a dear friend and it, you know, was teachers at Sims, teaches at Under 40, as well as other events. Her and another dear friend, Matthew Brett Silver, are going to be offering an online retreat at Cloud Mountain. Well, it's through Cloud Mountain, but it's online. And so that's in this chat there. So they both went through the teacher training with me, the 4-year teacher training through Spirit Rock and IMS. And they're dear friends, and they have a great depth of practice. So take a look at that and see if it fits into your schedule. It's, I believe, starts on May 6th on Thursday and goes till Sunday. So that's for your attention. And thank you again for your support of Sims and the teachers. And I look forward to seeing you next week, if not another time.